Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Final Cut Grill. This is 090 on the countdown to 100, 10 episodes away. Hey, we have a fun show today. You know, met Zeb Chatfield tonight through Twitter. I mean, I've been following Zeb Panoptic TV on Twitter for a long time. And, you know, he's got a ton of followers and a very interesting feed with all kinds of little tidbits about broadcast television and things like that. And also, Panoptic makes a time code calculator. It's an iOS app which you might want to check out on the there'll be a link and stuff like that. It's on the what's the thing called? The App Store. Yeah, it's late. Sorry, it's like 1:30 in the morning. And in order to talk to Zeb in London, this just turned out to be a better time of day. At any rate, the conversation was very interesting because Zeb does a lot of color grading. And so like the second half of this show, this interview, it's all about the Resolve, Final Cut, and the back and the forth. And he talks a lot about his own, you know, workflows. And we get into an interesting discussion at the end about, ranking. I kept wanting to say grading in the interview. I kept wanting to call it grading, but that obviously when you're talking about color grading tools, that's a bad word. But ranking various, Resolve versus Final Cut 10. So it's quite interesting. It's a fun interview. I want to thank the people from Premium Beat. I think I mentioned on the last show that I got to see a sneak preview peek, if you will, at their upcoming website upgrade. But it doesn't matter because, you know, the old website works great. I just downloaded three songs for a little 5-minute piece that I was cutting just today. I was finishing off, and the producer had downloaded the temp files, and he was like, "Hey, can you get me the full res versions?" And I used my little workflow tip, which is a tutorial on their website about how to swap those out. And you know, there's multiple ways to swap them out. My way works good for me. It may not be the best way for everybody else. So thank you, Premium Beat, for supporting what we're doing here. It means the world to us, and it's awesome. Anyway, let's go now to this interview with Zeb Chatfield of Panoptic TV, and he's over on the other side of the pond in London town.
Hello, Chris.
Hey, Zeb. How you doing?
I'm very well, man. How are you?
Thanks for chasing me down. I've been
that's cool.
It's so many people to talk to. Been meaning to hunt you down eventually.
Yeah, I think I tried a while back to have a chat, but it's fun listening to the show anyway. So it's cool to have a chat and be able to return. Well, just to be able to have a two-way conversation rather than mutter to myself on the on the tube.
I totally know what you mean. Yeah, I do that all the time with, you know, people always say, you know, one of these days we're going to have interactive television. I go, what are you talking about? I've been yelling at my TV for years.
Yeah, I'm just always listening because I grade most of the time, and I'll pretty much always listen to podcasts. I used to listen to music most of the time, but now I just... I'd spend more time trying to figure out which album to listen to next, whereas now I could just have a steady stream of podcasts. So I'm pretty glad that you're outputting so much content, really.
Somebody else tweeted me just the other day saying, whatever you do, don't stop doing shows. I need the two a week. So, yeah. So out of curiosity, what kind of stuff do you listen to?
Podcast-wise?
Yeah.
I listen to pretty much all really boring telly stuff, like anything to do with the technology and a bit of comedy. I do listen to Nerdist, but Tom Parrish, he's a good one for colorists and the coloristos. And Tom Parrish talks a lot about broadcast monitor calibration and stuff like that as well. So he's always speaking to SpectraCal and those kind of people. So yeah,
isn't it amazing how many? Like I tell you, you know, when you, I'll give you a little hint here. If you ever decide to make your own podcast, there's a hobby that you're going to absorb that is really disgusting and horrible. And that is the obsessive nature with which that you go to the iTunes and you look at the top 200 list.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's funny, you know, Ben Consoli and I tease each other about it all the time. He does the Go Creative show and we'll send each other screen grabs. Dude, your show's doing really good or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's a disgusting like obsession. And what's really funny is my friend Carl Olson, who I used to do digital conversions with,
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how I heard about your show as well, because I'd listened to Convergence. Oh, cool. And then I listened to the episode where you were talking about starting one, and then I sort of kept my eye out for it. So
yeah, that was the one where, you know, like Carl had kind of caught us all by surprise, and he's like, yeah, I'm stopping the show. I was like, what? Huh? What? Huh? What? What are you talking about? And then he went on vacation, and while he was on vacation, I came up with the idea of doing a cafe, and then, you know, the grill was just, I don't know what I was thinking when I started this one. It's just like, it's an obsession. But, so then Carl pointed out that you can actually go and change your iTunes settings to different countries.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, I can go see how it's ranking or not, more likely than not, in, like, yeah, Australia or England or any other English-speaking countries. And, yeah, I mean, I can look at other ones, but, I mean, it does.
And it must be doing all right because, I mean, you do have quite a lot of Australian and Kiwi and British guests and stuff. So I'm guessing, you know, people everywhere are listening.
It is astonishing. I think a few episodes ago I mentioned how, you know, it's weird to think that literally, I mean, because I can even look at the stats, you know, I use Libsyn to store the files, and you can look at the stats and you can look at countries around the world that are downloading, and it's daunting. It's very weird, but it's a privilege that people even bother listening. But
yeah,
I will. Give
well,
you,
I ran into Alex Golner at IBC a few weeks ago.
Alex 40.
Alex 40. Yeah, and it was weird because I kind of heard his voice and I looked at him and I didn't really recognize him, and then I saw his badge said Alex and I was like, are you Alex 4D? And that was purely from hearing him on the podcast talking to you.
That's hysterical. You know, another story was this last year at NAB, this guy comes up to me, goes, Chris Fenwick. And I looked at him and I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't know where I know you from. And somebody standing next to him started to go, oh, dude, this is – and he goes, no, don't tell him. I want to see him squirm. And I'm looking – I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't recognize you. And it was my friend Scott Simmons, who I've spoken to many times
you know,
on the phone and recording shows and stuff. But he's got this crap icon photo and that doesn't look the single thing like him. And I'd never met him in real life. So it is weird how you – relate to either like an icon,
it's weirder when it goes the opposite way. I mean, because you worked in broadcast for a while, you've probably had it where you're sort of staring at a celebrity's face for a long time, right, and then you run into them at a rap party or something, you think they're your friend or you know them, and you're like, oh hey, how's it going?
I don't know, you're the editor, go away, kind
of strange man.
Yeah, I did. That happens with me at events. I'll be editing in my hotel room for days on end, and then I go downstairs to go to dinner or something, and I run into faces in the elevator, and I'm like, you don't know me. Never mind. Creepy. So Zeb, tell me a little bit about your background. How long have you been in this business, and what kind of stuff have you done?
Yeah, so I'll do like a short background story, and then maybe if you are interested and want to talk it over more, we can do another show just about that, because it's it's excessive. But I've basically just always somehow been passionate about I guess it started off with film, but I'm from a family of like fishermen and hunters, so I'm from New Zealand originally, and I'm the weirdo from the family who does strange TV stuff. And then my dad always just says that I'm out hanging out with Tom Cruise and things to people. So it's all really weird. I started shooting. Like, I was obsessed when I was young with The Fast Show and Monty Python and all that kind of comedy, British comedy, young ones. And started shooting stuff with my friends on one of those big old VHS JVC cameras.
Yep.
And then I would edit tape to tape, so VHS editing.
Now hold on, did you have like proper edit systems, or did you just have two VCRs in the remotes?
Yeah, it was all I didn't know any of this stuff existed, because we didn't have – like, I didn't have the internet. Like, I'd never used a computer till I was about 18.
Yeah.
I'd like just seen people copy videos and then realized that I could maybe use, you know, how you could do a pause on the record deck,
yep,
and then spool the other one and then hit play and then unpause, and you would get a really nice clean cut going between decks.
It's like frightening to think what we used to do. I know.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I used to do that initially. I would like record Young Ones episodes off TV, and then I'd do that to get rid of ad breaks. And then when I started using the big VHS camera and shooting stupid stuff with my mates, then suddenly I thought, oh, maybe I can sort of put these together or compile them together, because we were doing sort of in camera and editing really to begin with. Yeah, and then eventually the cameras got better, and we got like DV cameras and stuff like that, and sort of carried on doing it. And then eventually I managed to save enough money to get a Mac, which was like an OS 9 MacBook. I'm trying to remember what they're all called now. PowerBook, Titanium PowerBook,
with
20 gig hard drive. It was quite epic. But that was my first ever computer, and it cost about $8,000 in New Zealand to buy that at the time. So it was stupidly expensive. But
now, that's not like $8,000 US. What was the exchange rate?
No, I mean, the exchange rate, well, at the time, the exchange rate was probably 2-1 or something. So it's probably about $4,000
okay.
US at the time.
That's still expensive, but it sounds much better than $8,000.
Yeah. I mean, it was huge, but it was kind of, in my mind, it was like, well, I'm getting this so that I can learn this craft that I'm passionate about. And it was like, I'd never went to university or even finished high school or anything. I left when I was like 15.
Right. Because you were raised by the wolves in the forest with your parents, right?
Yeah, basically. And, it was kind of assumed I would probably go into, something boat related, cause my dad was a fisherman and then runs a charter boat out to sea, seals and stuff. And I grew up looking after penguins. I had to feed penguins before I went to school and things like that. It sounds like I'm making this up, but it's real. That's what I'm saying. The career story is crazy because it's all over the place. But anyway, I'll sort of like skip ahead. So then I managed to sort of teach myself Final Cut Pro. I got a dodgy copy of that off a friend who was actually going to university.
When you say dodgy, was it dodgy because you got it from the friend or did he get it off the internet?
It was dodgy because I got it from the friend. And
yeah, because I remember.
It was probably dodgy because he probably got it off the internet, but I don't know if he could have got it.
Yeah, I was down in Australia in like 2002, and I remember having a conversation with a guy at a computer store once, and he said, because of internet speeds and the way that you guys were paying down, well, you guys, I'm sorry, I apologize, I'm lumping all Kiwis in. Yeah, your people in with the Aussies. But at least in Australia, the way that they were paying for their internet speed was that, and this just seems so archaic, but you would pay for every megabyte, both down and up, that you did if you had a high-speed account. And it was so expensive that he said it was actually more expensive to steal a copy of Photoshop than it was to just go to the store and buy it.
I don't know. And then I'm not sure about that. The biggest problem for us was the speed. Like I don't think I had broadband ever when I lived in New Zealand. I mean, so I lived in Australia for 8 years, and I lived here in the UK for 6. But in New Zealand, I was there until I was about 19 or 20, and I think we're on dial-up the whole time. So even just getting a song, you would leave downloading overnight.
Well, that's the other thing he said, is that in addition to having the broadband, which was very, very expensive, everybody had a dial-up account, which was basically essentially, you know, free download. It was just wicked slow. So people would start to download stuff, and they'd just leave their machine on for 3 days.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, our setup, I think, was a bit different to that. But, yeah, I don't really remember much of it.
It's interesting how time marches on, and now we have, you know, LTE downloads in our iPhone.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, our speeds are up over 100 meg, like, each way for the office.
Really? That's nice.
It's pretty sweet. Yeah, so... Yeah, got dodgy copy of Final Cut, and then so then I was basically self-taught on Final Cut, just figuring it out. But I used to do I'd spend an hour every day was like what I had set myself as a goal to you know, I figured if I did an hour a day, then within a few years I would be an all right editor. And then the film The Last Samurai was filmed in my hometown, which is a place called New Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
When that was filmed, someone was looking for an editor to help out with some stuff, and then and they got pointed to me because it's a small town, and I was the person who did editing. And then so he chatted to me, and then he wanted me to come and train him to do editing, to chop together. It was the stunt coordinator. He wanted to chop together choreography to show the director, and sort of show how it would look on screen. And so I spent a couple of hours with him each day. A couple of times a week, getting them set up and running. And he was paying me more to do that than I was making in my job at the time, because I was working at that point. I was working in an appliance store. Then I sort of thought maybe there's a career in this, and then I decided to go to Sydney because there's obviously a lot more opportunity, a lot more work,
right,
in Australia. And then went over there and I worked for Apple for a while, and I figured I'd use that to make contacts. So I worked at Apple, and this was before the iPods and any of that stuff had come out. So it was very much just the pro creative industry.
Would be like 99, 2000?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Then I was over there and dealing with all that. And making contacts and just helping out anyone I could for free for experience, weekends and after work and all that. And then eventually one of my clients sort of put me in touch with someone who became like a mentor, Scott Rowan. He was running a post-production company for a small in-house post for a production company called Crackerjack Productions. And they were doing a comedy sketch series, which was the main draw as well, because that's obviously what I really wanted to eventually get into doing. Then I started there, and they were a Final Cut setup, so that was really easy. They were bought out by Fremantle Media, who you guys have over there as well, so you're probably familiar. And then we moved to Avid at that point. With any editor that's used to editing in one system, you get a bit grumpy about making a move to a different system, or if your whole system's just discontinued and they replace it with something completely foreign. That happened to me. And then my sort of approach with that, because I work in finishing, so I don't cut. Again, that's part of the longer story, but I grade and online, and that's become my favorite parts. For me, doing that side of the job, you really have to understand the complete sort of underworkings of everything. So when I moved to Avid, I changed to nights for a couple of months and did Avid conforms and sort of, batch capturing from all the tapes from Digis and all the rest of it, just to get my head around the back end, how all that worked. Because, if you can't understand that, then it's very hard to fix problems if you encounter them when you're doing in the finish.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. I mean, I remember I was having a discussion with, I'm going to have to make an edit here because I feel like a tard for not remembering the guy's name.
We know you don't edit anything out, Chris. We hear all these things where you say, I'm going to make an edit, and then you just don't bother.
I know.
Like, I'll make an edit here. Bugger it.
When I was talking with Austin Flack, the Avid editor, he was even admitting, he goes, oh yeah, there's a lot of that, edit assist stuff I have a real hard time doing, because it's, he's so down at the, the frame level. It's that whole back end. And it doesn't surprise me. I mean, there's always got to be somebody around who really knows all of it, and it doesn't surprise me that's the finishing guy.
In the big post houses, often you'll get people, you'll have a tech, and you could very much like, you could say, hey, this is freaking out, can you sort it? But it's not, for me, it's not very time efficient. I'll get a day to do a grade, a day to do it online, and then it has to be out the door. And I mean, if you've got that's fine if you excuse me, if you've got a program that's all shot rushes and everything's done nice and it's really simple, but you know, about probably 60-70% of what I do is documentaries. It's filled with archive, and you know, you've got wrong frame rates and needing to do standards conversion and arcing and you know, all the rest of it.
Totally, yeah, so, it's a big deal. You were talking about the digging and frame conversions.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time in that sort of world, you're doing like hardware based frame conversions, right?
Yeah. So I'm still yet to find a software frame converter that I'm happy with.
What's your current favorite?
So I'm a big advocate of the Terranex.
Yeah.
Not just because it's cheap. Like, I mean, it used to be a lot more. Over here, everyone uses an Alchemist. Like, is pretty much the standard, and that's by Snell and Wilcox. But it's just a standard here, whereas around the rest of the world, I've usually found that people use Terranex or various other things. But I got the Terranex, obviously, because of the price, but the quality of the conversions is so good. And then you, like, you know, couple that with a HyperDeck or a Kai Pro or something, and you can just run straight through into media. And if I'm doing a job for Avid, like with the HyperDeck, you can record directly into, you know, Avid compatible MXFs. So you don't have to do, you know, import them or anything. Just chuck them in your media files folder and they just pop up.
And so for people that don't know, a Terranex is it's like a single rack unit box. It's made by Blackmagic now. They've bought it out and they sell it. And it is like the cool way to do, like if you had like old Beta SP and you have to quote unquote bump it up to HD, you're saying that's far and away better than any software conversion, right?
Yeah, or even downloaded archive from various archive sites. I was doing a BBC job the other day, you know, in Avid and Final Cut and all of that, they all have their own little algorithms for up-resing. And I mean, DaVinci Resolve has a really, really powerful one. It is great, but still nothing comes close to hardware in that regard. So I'll always, you know, I'm not one of these guys that's going to sit here and just go like, hardware's the best and it always will be. I mean, I'm sure software will eventually get there, but at this stage, like, I'll try every other option, because of course I always want my, you know, mundane things that I don't really want to be fucking around with to speed up if I can. But at the end of the day, real time through hardware is, you know, just 20 times faster and easier and better than any other, you know, result that I can get.
It's so funny. I mean, we've actually, in our office, we've gotten rid of our last tape deck. I mean, we don't have any tape decks anymore.
But they come in handy.
They do. And
what if something comes in and they're like, we need this?
Okay, and we'll find it. Seriously, quite often we'll send the tape out and just, here, dig this for me, you know?
Yeah.
It's for the amount of times we actually need it. You know, we don't have a whole lot of space. And to have, you know, 8 units or whatever of rack space tied up, it's like, ugh, you know, it's just, no, that's fine. I'll get rid of it. But we did have a thing just recently where we had to pull a bunch of archival stuff, and we monkeyed around and came up with a software solution, and I can't remember exactly what it was now, but I was even saying, you know, from what I understand, we should try the Terranex, and, you know, we didn't have any tape decks around. It's kind of hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, and lots of people use the standard seems to be software-wise, seems to be Telestream Engine. Is it Episode Engine?
Right.
Yeah, and... but it's awful. It's just, you know, I go into places all the time, the conforms will be done, everything's all prepped, and I'll pull it up and you just look at it and you just go, what the fuck is wrong with this? And it's at that stage, it's gone through like 2 or 3 layers of being converted, and you have to kind of track down where it all went wrong, and it just becomes so much more work, because, you know, the hardest thing is you get a bunch of, you know, they're doing their job, but a lot of junior operators, and they won't really understand, you know, they really have to interrogate all the footage and look at it. You look at every shot and think, what's wrong with this? You know, you don't sort of go, yeah, it looks all right, and just move along. You and find the fault.
It's easy to do. It's so easy to do to just like think that we're so used to computers just like solving problems for us. And a lot of times we overtrust them.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I have a question for you, and this is a little bit off topic, but I'm sure you could answer it, given your panoptic, you know, time code calculator.
Yeah, yeah.
Why? Explain like I'm five, which is a meme on Reddit. Explain like I'm five. Why is it that HD is 24 frames in the US and 25 in Great Britain? Or I'm
this
sure
is like,
other places.
You're about to start me on like a rant, and my, my big cup of coffee that I've just drunk is probably going to be kicking in too. So,
well, since it's the end of my day and I'm really tired, I'm totally cool to just kind of slouch back and let you rant for a while.
I mean, realistically, the truth of it, you know, with HD and also going to Ultra HD is that there's not really any purpose for it. I mean, I would prefer if when HD came along, everyone went, yeah, we're getting rid of all these stupid frame rates and we're going to go with, we'll have internationally, you know, 24 or 48, or it may be like, you know, 24i, 24p or whatever. And just have that as a standard, and it, you know, it's just would make life easy, and everything would be cross compatible with cinema and back and forth. You wouldn't be having to do all these weird conversions and stuff that I spend a lot of my life dealing with. Really, it's just to be backwards compatible. So it's, you know, I've traveled sort of all over America, and most of the places you go, there's still not HD, and there's still 4.3 tallies all over the place. Same throughout Europe. And if you were to pull the plug on support for all of those different time codes in those different countries, the making versions that are cross compatible with SD down conversion for broadcast and all that kind of thing would just be a nightmare.
Now, you know, recently I had a deliverable that was going to Europe for something. And even though everything was shot 29.97, and it was, you know, like, I think it was an HD deliverable frame size. They said, oh yeah. And we have to have it. We have to have a 50 frames per second, which I guess would be 24 interlaced. I don't know.
Yeah, they'll have 50i. I mean, standard.
Now, if I had delivered 24p to them, would it? What would it do in the projection there?
Well, it depends on the delivery. So all of my delivery is to broadcast, so it would just fail tech review and get sent back.
Oh yeah, understood.
You know, But over here, it wouldn't necessarily be a problem depending on what they're running. So if they've got a digital projector, it would most likely support 24 or 29.97. So they probably just have a standard that someone's just pulled from something else and just told you to adhere to it and not really thought about why they're asking you to do that or anything.
Those kind of things drive me nuts.
Well, yeah, man.
You could totally tell somebody's
that's the pain of my life.
They're copying and pasting, you know, some tech thing, and it's not really relevant. Nope, it's got to be this. Not really.
It's worse when it's a big broadcaster. I mean, you can look through National Geographic, like tech specs and Discovery tech specs, and you'll find like contradictions on every other page, and that's when it's really irritating, because that's our Bible. You know, like we sit there with a tech spec and just make sure every single you know, item is ticked and done and perfect. And and when, you know, on one page they're telling us that you know, every frame, the start of each part needs to come in on the first frame of the second, and then at the end of the part you have to have two frames of black before the start of the next part, but then the next part needs to come on the first frame of the second. It's physically impossible, obviously. And then they'll ask you then they'll ask you to you know, on a 29.97 delivery, there'll be like you know, last frame of picture has to be at, like, I forget what it was, something like 42.00, but 42.00 doesn't exist. It jumps the two frames for drop frame.
Right.
And like, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so those are really the really irritating things, because everything does have to be frame accurate. And when you've got a spec that is telling you for something to finish on one frame that doesn't exist, then you can get pretty
you know, my pet peeve is when I get and this is slightly different, but it's similar in that you're looking at the letter of the law when you're looking at branding guidelines. And people will give you color swatches for the colors that are legit to use. And they will have CMYK and RGB values. And you start going through them. Now, what you could do, and I would not recommend you actually do this, but what a lot of people will do is they'll just color pick the swatches off of the PDF and go, yep, got those, totally got it, moving on. No, you don't do that. What you want to do is you want to use the RGB values.
Mm.
My pet peeve is when you start looking at it and you realize, oh, the RGB value for the blue square is the same as for the green square because some layout artist copy and pasted it and they never went in and actually put in the actual values. Drives me nuts. Like, really? You think that's going to be blue? I don't think so. Not when the green value is that high.
Yeah, but then you end up in an NLE as well, and it's YUV. That's another thing that I get all the time. You'll have people importing H.264 files into Avid, and you do have to tell it if the source is RGB or YUV, or you know RGB or Rec. 709. When you do that, do it wrong. It's all, to me, it's very obviously wrong. You look at it in your scopes and it's either crushed or blown out or something. But typically people just import it and think they've imported it right and not really question it. Goes back to that.
So this this would be a really good point to transition into what this show is about.
Yeah.
So how does... And I do have a question that I want to ask you for my friend Ben Consoli. But what do you think a tool like Final Cut does in terms of making these things easier or problematic in terms of true broadcast work?
Yeah, so I mean, when Final Cut 10 first came out, I got it on day one, and I was working at a big post house at the time. And obviously everyone else just kind of poo-pooed it. But I sort of sat there and I played with it. And at the time, it didn't have broadcast monitor support. So for me, it was unusable just for that. But the software I could see was amazing. So to me, I was kind of looking through it, and I'm... having worked at Apple, I kind of and I've been a little bit of a fanboy. I kind of looked at it all a little bit differently, you know. And the way, you know, the obvious thing is that they're not telling me that I have to give up everything I have right now and start using this. They're saying that this is where they're going. That they could have said this is where we're going, and not sort of released it the way they did. But anyway, playing with it and seeing just. Right from day one, they had that proxy on-off tick box and automatic creation of proxies and optimized media. And that one thing alone for me, I was just like, this is going to be the best application that's ever been made for what I do. It's working in tally work where, you know, you're on shared storage and spaces is limited, and the amount of rushes that people are shooting is just going up and up and up and up and up. We're getting stuff back on 10 or 15 different cameras, all from different manufacturers, and you know it's getting crazy. Having a really solid proxy workflow built into the app is huge. And Avid are trying to replicate that with a new version of Media Composer that's going to be coming out that's going to finally get resolution independence, but it's not true resolution independence. It goes up to UHD and that's it. But Final Cut 10, right at the start, I just thought, you know, this is going to be great. For me as a finishing guy, it's going to prevent all the people that come before me from screwing everything up. You know, they can just bring everything in as source. They just take all the media, whatever, frame rate, all the rest of it, and don't think about it. Just chuck it into Final Cut, have it optimize your media, or have it create your proxy media, and just have that tick box turned on, and then work away as you would. So just get to editing, get to storytelling. And then when it comes back to me, I can just untick that, and I've got access to all the source media untouched. And so I know at that point, anything that's wrong with it's actually wrong with the source. It's not something that someone's done wrong.
That's a really interesting observation that I just had never really thought of, that – is that how do I say this? So the proxy and the optimize allows the the editor and let's be clear, and I think that if people have never worked in a broadcast environment, you don't really understand the draconian measures that are foisted upon you from the the engineering staff. And and in the States, PBS was the most difficult to get stuff through, or at least it used to be back when I used to work at a PBS station, where you literally have somebody just staring down a scope and they'll see like one little thing wrong and they'll reject your whole show.
Yeah.
And they'll give you somewhat of an explanation, but it's like you have to have your engineering chops to be able to make sure that stuff actually gets to go to air.
Yeah, it needs to be perfect. I mean, one dead pixel, one little line of blanking, one caption that's just over the safe area, all of that sort of stuff. It has to be perfect. So anything that helps us to achieve that is a big deal.
So what you're saying is that the proxy allows the editor to just edit, and then you have access to all of his raw media to go back and check things. Now, will you then do a whole bunch of conforming afterwards?
So technically, I mean, unless the archive they had needed to be sort of eye matched and replaced, like if they're working with all, in regards to like standard media, I wouldn't, in a Final Cut 10 world, I wouldn't need to do a conform. I would just untick the box that says use proxy media, and I would be linked to the source media. So unless something needed to, at that point, be standards converted, or have something done to it, then that would be the end of the job. That would be it. Just tick box, done.
I don't know if I mentioned this in a recent episode, but I had a thing where it was a piece that had a bunch of different media in it, and a handful of it was red media. Mm-hmm. And I had thought, well, you know what? I never used the proxy thing, but I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to try the proxy.
Yeah.
And so when I brought in the red stuff, I said, yeah, proxy that. But I was a little disappointed that the proxy checkbox was an all or nothing. If every bit of media didn't have proxy media, I was going to have a bunch of red frames.
Yeah. And yeah, I agree. I mean, they should make it refinable. So maybe you could say anything above HD proxy.
Stuff I choose to proxy. Because in this particular piece, I had GoPro footage, I have DSLR, I think I had some ARRI in it, and it was some red. And that's what true. I ended up doing, and it was, this is a feature that I think a lot of people forget about, because by and large, at least in my world, I'm not really worried about performance issues. But in the playback options in the viewer, there's a little pull down there, and there's a thing for better performance or better quality.
Yeah.
And typically we have it set for quality because we're all quality hounds and we want to see our images look really good. But what I ended up doing instead of, because I had so much media that it was completely inconceivable that I was going to proxy all of it. Yeah. What I ended up doing is just changing it to better performance. And that was enough to allow me to deal with the red footage in a way that was, smooth and doable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the situation in broadcast is more for using that in shared storage. So not having to take up, with large media files, like the whole system, or whole storage system. I think something like that would be great. That's one for your, if I could sneak in the back door of Apple things, to have that would be great. And maybe they would do it like you say, where you just, anything that does, that has a proxy, will use the proxy. And then maybe anything that doesn't have a proxy just gets colored in your timeline differently, or made sort of gray, or, whatever, something to indicate that that is the actual media. It's not proxy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry. I totally interrupted you. Your thought process.
Yeah. I mean, with that, so I mean, that was the first thing for me, which was a big one. And then once you look into all the resizing tools, so right from day one, you know, it was a lot of the Ken Burnsy stuff for, you know, pan and zooming on stills and doing, you know, nice moves and A to B moves and, you know, all that kind of stuff. There was a lot of things in there that had been refined that had always pissed me off in Final Cut 7 and in Avid and Premiere and any other NLE I put my fingers on. They kind of didn't have a lot of this stuff that just made, you know, it just makes the end result better without the extra work, you know. So if I can do that, like anything I can use to do that quicker and easier, again, it adds to the quality of what I can deliver. And so there was a lot of those sorts of features right from day one in Final Cut 10 that got me quite excited. Again, I just sort of knew that I would have to wait until broadcast, you know, monitor support came along, so I could sort of interrogate everything properly again, see it pixel for pixel, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And then obviously it's just kept evolving over the years, and I've just since day one just kept chucking anything in there that I could. So if I was doing a little project, I mean, when I was back in New Zealand at one point, I made a little film on my iPhone with my nephews. We just ran around and made a spy movie, and then I sat with them and edited it in Final Cut 10. That was probably my first thing that I had cut properly, but literally anything I could chuck in there, I would. I tried to do I tried to do a lot of international reversions of stuff. I don't know if you'd get it over there, but there's this show here called Hairy Bikers, and it's about some chefs. And they're bearded chefs, and I was doing some international versions of one of their shows recently. And chuck them in there. And that was when I hit my first sort of major Final Cut problem that I saw as being sort of like a deal breaker until something gets resolved. And you guys, you know, you're always talking about it, but it's the audio options. But for me specifically, being able to get multi-track out and listen to them simultaneously. So if I'm doing international reversions, I might have a mix on track 1 and 2 and then an M&E on track 2 and 3. And I can lay that up in Final Cut 10 and I can get the rolls set right and I can do almost everything. But when I want to actually do a review, I want to be able to have all those channels coming out properly and be able to flick on like an external box through those SDI audio channels to make sure I'm in sync and make sure everything's, you know, I need to do that live and be able to hear the M&E and make sure it's at the right point and I've got the right material on there and sort of like a quality control sort of thing.
You're saying you want to be able to do that in the editor.
Yeah.
So basically, I mean, all your roles.
Final Cut 10 if that was in there. So I want my roles to represent and potentially assign roles to tracks like audio output tracks. So I'll have my SDI signal coming out of my in my systems. They're mostly Ultra Studio 4K at the moment, because that just works with everything. And I'll have my SDI signal going into my reference monitor, and also an SDI signal going into an audio de-embedder, so I can have all the separate tracks going out into a mixer, and then I can sort of enable and disable tracks as I please.
Well, so, let me ask you a question. Does it solve the problem to just enable and disable the role in the timeline index?
Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of the workaround. But what I want to do is be able to. I need to review exactly what I'm delivering and know it's going to be correct. If I'm doing that, say I'm doing a proper QC, I would like to be able to play it from start to finish and not have to sit there and enable, disable, and, you know, play forward and all that kind of stuff. I want to just hit go and be able to, on my mixer, just go like, you know, track 3 and 4, track 1 and 2, and so on and so forth if I've got more tracks.
And you're saying that if I'm about to, now I feel like I need to launch Final Cut here. You're saying that if I'm rolling... If I was rolling, if I had the ability to roll and mute I'm using the same word two different ways.
Track. So
if I'm actually playing my timeline,
Yeah.
If I were able to mute and unmute a role without stopping playback, would that solve the problem for you?
No, because it doesn't tell me that what I'm delivering has those channels assigned correctly.
Okay.
So, you know, as much as I can be confident in what I have done, and I still, I'll check everything 10 times to make sure it's perfect. So even if I set those, the roles for those audio tracks to go to the right place, so when I export my file, for delivery, they're going to the right channels. I've still at that point when I create that file, I've still not actually listened to those channels independently, and you know, can be 100% confident what I'm delivering is the exact right assignment. You know,
I guess the real question is if you had a piece of hardware, and this is actually very interesting to me, but I will fully admit I'm kind of making this up because I don't do what you're doing, so
yeah.
I'm sort of faking it here. But it seems like if you had a piece of hardware that would read the role information and send each track out of a different jack, essentially, on the back of that piece of hardware, like some sort of audio interface box that the roles would speak to properly.
Yeah. So I mean, all of those audio options already exist in my SDI chain, like up to 16 channels, I think.
Okay.
So all it needs is for Final Cut to actually say those roles go to those channels.
Okay.
And that would be it, you know, and then that would be my piece of software. I mean, you know, the only other thing aside from that is grading. Not being able to use a proper set of grading panels is a bit slow for my liking. But yeah, apart from that, that's the big one for me, because everything that I'm delivering will at least have a mix and an M&E, on separate tracks. So. And I want to, being as pedantic as I am, check that as thoroughly as possible.
Okay, so Zeb, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you a question for my friend Ben Consoli.
Yeah, cool.
Okay, so here's the deal. Can you walk through both the sort of advertised, yep, this is the way it should work, and then also the, and we all know that these things crop up, the little things that like, yeah, they don't tell you this, but make sure you click on this box and do it in this order.
Mm.
Can you walk through the workflow from taking a timeline in Final Cut 10 and getting it through Resolve and back?
Yeah. So, the thing is that there's like a load of different ways to do it. And I mean, from whatever NLE you're going to, you can just take the direct like source media straight in and back. The tricky thing in my line of work, like I've said, it's all very, very fast paced. So, you know, I'm arriving in the morning and I've got to get a program out of Final Cut, Classic 10, Avid, Premiere, whatever,
yeah.
Chuck it into Resolve, do my grade, send it back. Do you know, and then the next day hopefully if I've got 2 days, sometimes they'll cram it all into one day, but then yeah, if I've got, you know, provided I've got the right amount of time, I'll then have the next day to go through and refine it, add, you know, resizes, Ken Burnsy stuff on stills and captions, credits, clocks, slates, you know, the bars and yeah, all that kind of stuff, and then create textless elements at the end of a program. So I've got a lot of people, especially people that have more time than me, are going to sit there and go like, oh, you can't do that. But I will typically, I will do a pre-grade process. You know, if you want a surefire way to get your cut straight out of whatever NLE you're in and then into a grade and then back to the NLE and know that it's all going to look right and link correctly, it's really to do a pre-grade in the NLE, make sure you're happy with the program as it is, do a mix down and then bring in an EDL to chop it up. That time-wise is the most effective, because if you go through the process, which so from Final Cut 10, I have done it plenty of times when I'm sort of testing workflows and stuff, and I did a red job, which was originally cut on Premiere, and then I found Premiere was being a bit clunky, so I thought I'd give it a test in Final Cut 10, sent it over to Final Cut 10, and it was flying. That was another really good example of Final Cut 10's power. But yeah, I took that into Final Cut 10 and then sent it from there into Resolve. Again, my Premiere XML was having trouble at the time. This is a few years ago coming into Resolve, but the FCP XML came in fine to Resolve. So I think they do have a really refined, like it's almost like they're sharing some knowledge in the back rooms of Blackmagic and Final Cut.
It sure seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. And even now in Resolve, you get your, what do they call it in Final Cut? The versions, you know, when you can have
auditions.
Auditions. So you get those into Resolve now as well. You can right click and switch auditions.
Wow.
So that's pretty incredible. So Shorefire.
Getting it back from Resolve. So and now, correct me if I'm wrong. Because for a second there, it sounded like you were saying you pre-grade it in 10. So basically, you rough it in.
Yeah.
Then you, are you saying kick it out and do scene detection in Resolve?
No. So you would, how would you do that? Yeah. Because you can't get an EDL out straight out of
10.
10. So I would probably take, how would I do it? I would probably take an XML of the cut at that point and then use that to chop it up. I mean, the jobs that I've taken in from 10, so you could bring that XML into a separate track and then just manually just, you know, make your way through and just blade till the, you know, every cut point and copy the transitions across.
So you are saying that you take the full res output and not using scene detection, but by using the XML, you're going to cut up the master kick out.
Yeah. Again, you could use scene detection, but everything I do is about getting it done quickly. And if scene detection has, you know, one missed shot or something, that could create headaches for me down the line.
Sure,
I'll use some method for chopping it up in Resolve and then cracking on and just getting it done.
It's interesting. So you're not actually accessing the raw source media.
Yeah, but again, that depends on the project. You know, like I've got an Avid project coming up soon, and that's all been shot 4K. Avid doesn't support 4K, so I will be doing a conform and Resolve. So, you know, every project has its own different workflow, you know. So often with Avid now, there's a setting in there where so since version 7.03, there's a setting when you're exporting an AAF, you can say mix down effects to V1. So what it will do is when you bring that into Resolve, that's kind of my favorite workflow at the moment, because I'll take that into Resolve and anything that's an effect will be mixed down to V1. So I'll access the Avid media file that's been created in that mix down. But the rest of the source media will just link to the source media. And so you could replicate something similar to that in Final Cut 10, but you would have to do it manually like we used to have to do it in Avid, where you would have to go through each shot that has an effect of some sort and mix that down. And then you could send it through and link back easily enough. But, you know, the round trip, the proper round trip stuff works. You can just send an FCP XML into Resolve, linked to the media, but you need to take in that situation, you would take a mix down of the program as it was in Final Cut 10 as well, and just sort of either put it on another track with opacity, or sort of, you know, click through and just keep sort of enabling, disabling the track, and just make sure every clip lines up and do a bit of prep like that.
It should
be done prior to me getting to it, really. You know, like we've got a few junior operators at my post place, and they are sort of being trained up at the moment to do all that sort of stuff. Like, so it would be nice for us to be able to do it all the way that I would like it to be done, which is connecting to all the source media, just for the sake of it being a bit easier, and you get sort of various links from the source media, and you can have, you know, linked grades if Resolve's accessing the same media and you use remote grading, it will automatically grade across the clip. So if you grade, you know, one interview, it's likely that the whole interview will be graded next time you hit a shot and stuff like that.
It always surprises me how much eye matching gets done in conforming and color grading.
Yeah, yeah, it's irritating. I mean, that's why that's the beauty of doing everything at full res. I mean, you can kind of jump past a bunch of those problems, but it's just not a reality in my broadcast world for most things.
You mentioned earlier that if you had access to use proper grading panels, you know, like what do they call it? Like the tangent is one of them, and the is that the wave? Maybe that's the same one, or the element.
Yeah.
So if you had access to use those, would you be? And I realize maybe not. Would it be acceptable for you to grade with the color board if you had panels?
Yeah. So I don't know how they would relate to the color board. That's the confusing part, because obviously with the standard sort of HSL setup, the balls and all the buttons and whatnot, they kind of relate directly to what you're seeing on screen. But in the color board, it's like a different
metaphor.
Yeah, entirely. So maybe it's that they develop that, you know, it'd be developed a little bit differently. Or like you, I think you've mentioned a few times, the Hawaiki color or whatever. They've got some cool stuff in there. And I mean, if that could integrate with panels, and that would probably work around it. But the thing with that is, I don't think you would have access to the color science that's going on. So all of colors, like maths and science that went into that app is living in Final Cut 10. And you kind of get, when you do enough grading in different systems, you get a feel for how they act with color. And so when I work with the color board, even though the way it works is different, it feels like the way that it treats the color and brightness and everything, it treats it the same way color used to when I was using color.
That's really interesting.
Or Final Touch because I started on Final Touch was the first time I used that before Apple bought it.
So of the main color grading tools, what is your tool of choice?
Well, it's become Resolve. Just again, it's a speed thing. I did a Bear Grylls series over here called The Island with Bear Grylls, where he just drops a bunch of people on an island.
Right.
I did that was my sort of first big Resolve job on the new Mac Pro. So I'd done loads of Resolve over the years, but that was my first one with the new beast. And typically with any system I've used to grade, it's pretty much real time to get my files out at the end of the day. But with Resolve on the new Mac Pro, each episode, which is about 45 minutes long, would render out in about 16 to 17 minutes.
Wow.
And that's rendering to DNX HD 185X, so 10-bit DNX codec. So it's not a particularly easy codec to render by comparison to
ProRes. So you're doing three times real time.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's huge.
One-third real time. How do you even say that? A 45-minute show in 15 minutes, essentially.
Yeah, one-third. Yeah. So, yeah, it's that was a big deal for me. So, it's made it possible for us to potentially do on really fast turnaround programs. When you get something that's, you know, on air tomorrow, we could do the grade and online at the same time, and then I can sort of quickly export the grade straight into the online, and then play out at the end of the day to file for delivery or to tape whatever.
I can't remember where I saw it, and frankly, it may have been Ben Consoli. Again, thanks, Ben. Somebody did a demo where they took a shot out of 10, sent it over to Resolve, did a grade in Resolve, and then kicked out a little. What do they call it in the color world? I'm sorry, I'm making a fool of myself here. You call
what is it?
A LUT. A LUT.
Oh, yeah.
So he makes a LUT from there. He then goes back into Final Cut 10, and you can actually apply LUTs from the outside world.
Yeah.
So, like, you could, in theory, if somebody was cutting down the hall, you could be going through his footage and going, this is going to have to be treated like this, 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 and this. And then if you named him a certain way and put him in a shared location, he could go, oh, yeah, let me, you know, here's the – exteriors. Here's the sit down interview. Here's the confessional. Here, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a potential interesting workflow.
Yeah, I think it would be. It would potentially turn into a bunch of fiddling, but I mean, you could do that. you would do that into that's like a pretty standard sort of DIT workflow a lot of the time. So if you're doing a bunch of stuff where you might in Resolve, you're looking at the rushes on set, and you can be applying you know, rough looks with the DP, and then you could generate those as LUTs, and then whoever is doing bringing all the media into whatever editing system you're using, they could be applying them, or you could output the media straight from Resolve for the edit with the LUT applied, with like a, you know, the proxy workflow in mind. So you would have proxy media with the LUT applied, and then you would still connect back to your source media. You know, there's lots of really interesting workflows that have opened up with the use of LUTs, because obviously it used to be just used if you were outputting to film to just compensate for the color change that you would get from different film stock. But
right.
And now we're sort of using them in a whole different way for looks and for, you know, I guess previs, maybe, to use a word from our graphics friends.
So let me get back to this line of question, because and then we'll wrap it up here. But so Resolve is your color grading tool of choice.
Now, yeah.
If you were going to give that a gray, a mark, I don't want to use the word grade because it's confusing, but if you wanted to rank it, let's say, on a scale of 1 to 10, meaning 1 is I'm sitting in front of one of my old Beta SP machines and I have set up video hue and saturation. That would be like a 1 in terms of color grading. And then 10 being your ideal tool, 1 to 10. What would you grade rank? Resolve today.
So today, I mean, I think that I'd have to give it like an 8 or 9. It could probably have better restoration tools, but it's incredible. And I mean, the biggest thing for me in the Resolve world is just that the engineers, and I've said it 100 times on the Panoptic feed, like they just don't sleep. Like as soon as ProRes XQ, was it XQ that just came out not so long ago?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, as soon as that came out, Resolve had support for it in a couple of days. Like,
wow.
And it's the same with any Red, you know, it's not just an Apple friend thing. It's like they'll have a new Red thing will come out and, you know, it's out straight away. It's just kind of incredible. So the developers are really great. I mean, I use Nakoda Filmmaster and I'll use Baselight and I'll, the craft is kind of the same regardless of what you use. And they, like I said before, they all have their own different sort of ways of dealing with color that are slightly different. But in general, I would happily just be on Resolve all the time. And I recently picked up the Boris effects for Resolve as well. So now if I've got like rushes with a dead pixel or something like that, I can just chuck that straight onto the whole timeline as an effect, and that's going to fix the dead pixel wherever it is using the plugin in Resolve. And again, that's much quicker than using the same plugin in Avid. I can render it out a lot faster.
And then one last question. If you were going to give the same ranking to if your hands were tied and the only option you had was to do all of your color work in Final Cut 10, how would you grade that how would you rank that on a scale of 1 to 10? Same scale.
So I would rank it about 3, but not because of the software. Like the software is fantastic. I think the way it works with color is fantastic, and the vignetting and inside outside masks and all the rest of it. It's brilliant.
Where does it fall short?
It falls short on interaction, like being able to. It's literally just the panel side of things. I mean, you can't get through Final Cut 10 really quickly when you're having to fiddle around with like your Wacom or your mouse with little pucks on screen. It's just it's just too slow. Speed wise, I mean, if you were using Final Cut 7 with a mouse or something, you're probably going to be, you know, comparatively, it's probably going to be a similar sort of speed. I mean, it's slightly different, so you have to relearn a little bit, you know, how to move things. And but, you know, the technology is the same. When you're limited to actually interacting with your mouse or Wacom, you're always going to be limited with your speed. You can't just kind of keep flicking through shots and just bashing away on the panels. Right. You know, so that's the only place it falls down.
No, that's
the technology is great.
That's very interesting. And, you know, Sam Messman, who's been on the show several times, I think he recently published a set of, and I don't even know what you call it. Sorry, Sam. But I think it is it's a patch, if you will, where you can use, I believe it was the tangent panels to a great degree, but not a complete degree with Final Cut 10. Like you got everything but the balls.
I think I remember, I definitely remember one of you guys talking about it, and I've been meaning to give it a test and see what I think. So I'd be really interested to give that a go when I get some spare time. And see what kind of results I get from that.
Envision a future where you could do had all the power of Resolve's color grading inside of Final Cut 10?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would love that. I'm a big advocate for staying in one system. And I think, I mean, at the moment, I've had jobs where I've just sent stuff into Final Cut 10 and just done all the moves on all the stills and output titles, like done all the titles for a program a couple of months ago, and output all the files with alpha channels straight out of 10 and into Avid, just because the text in Avid's really soft. And I liked the nice, sharp, pretty text that I could get out of 10, so I did that. So I'll always just use whatever tool suits the job best. I'm really kind of, I guess they call it like NLE agnostic, or probably grade system and NLE agnostic. But I'll work on Lightworks and Premiere and all the rest of it, and I'm always sort of trying different things. So even for encoding, I'll try Media Encoder from Adobe, and I'll try Compressor, and I'll try Sorensen Squeeze and Episode, and I'm always sort of testing things, because software keeps updating and technology keeps changing, and I keep wanting to utilize the best parts of whatever software I need to use. But I've kind of gone off on a tangent now.
No, it's fine. I'm going to have to wrap this up because it's getting late here. I know you're just starting your day. It's the end of mine here. Zeb, you're going to have to come back. This was great chat. It was a lot of fun.
Great, great. Glad it's called a different comeback for a chat.
But I will...
maybe we can do a career chat on the Cinema Cafe.
That's a very good idea. That's a very good idea. All right, man. I'll let you go. Thanks for everything.
All right. Sleep well.
Take care.
Bye.
All right. There you go. Da Vinci gets a 9. The color boards get 3. But to be fair, I just want to point out, and Zeb did say this, that his biggest complaint about color grading in 10 is not the software. He's actually very happy with the software. And it was interesting. He said that the way it deals with the color very much reminded him of the way Apple Color worked. So maybe there's some shared code there. Who knows? But his real beef was just the physical interface. He says you can't work quickly and fastly with a mouse or a stylus. You really need support for, some sort of color wheel, input device thing, which all the color grader boys really dig. So, hey, maybe we could get that. I think I don't see why Apple couldn't work with somebody. And I also realize that a round color ball doesn't match the square metaphor, if you will, of what the color board is. But I got to think there's got to be, there's some smart people out there. Let's figure it out. And maybe it's, maybe it's 4 trackpads or 3 trackpads side by side instead of 4 wheels. At any rate, great talking to Zeb. And I got to imagine he'll be back again. That was a fun chat. He and I also talked that, eventually we're going to, when we come back with more, cafe shows, his early part of his career is quite interesting. And we may want to do that on a cafe episode, one day. Let's go now. You know, as I've mentioned many times before in the past on the show, that if you go to Digital Cinema Cafe on the right-hand side, there's a little tab, and you can click on that guy, and you can leave me a little voicemail, and we can roll those into the show. So I got one of those this week, and this is from Daryl, and MVP Daryl. And let's – I think I have this potted up. If I hit this button, we should be able to hear what he says.
Hi. I was just wondering, what does the next iteration of Final Cut Pro 10 offers in new features?
Okay, Daryl. So I'm going to assume when you say the next iteration, you mean the current iteration. Because as we all know, when it comes to all things Apple, nobody knows anything about what's coming up next. And if people do know, believe me, they're not going to tell you because they like their jobs too much. But I will say in the current iteration, which is the, what some people are referring to, like Oliver Peters refers to it as the 10.12/10.13 version, because it's basically the same thing, but there was a big bug fix with 10.13. But the 10.12, 10.13 version, the main thing, it really is a big deal. And I've talked about this many times on the show. Excuse me, I won't cut that out. I've talked about this many times on the show, that the main thing that we get with the 10.12, 10.13 is that we get the ability to control where the software stores its render files and its media files. And we always used to be able to do save our media in place or leave media in place when we import it. But this is a bigger deal. This new iteration of where you store the media is, where are you storing the proxy media? Where are you storing the render media? Where are you storing the optimized media? So we can now store that stuff outside of the library. And in doing so, we keep our library file very small and much more network friendly, if you will. And, you know, we talked a lot about this recently when we talked to Peter Wiggins. That was on episode 080, episode 80, about 10 episodes ago. And Peter talked all about doing the Tour de France summary shows on BBC in England. So that might be something to look back at if you want to hear more, a lot more about the let me just type here, Tour de France. I should totally be doing this someplace else. At any rate, that's worth taking a look at episode 80 with Peter Wiggins. All right, so I think that's it for this episode. Thanks so much for the comments on the iTunes. Please go leave those and rank the show with some stars. Obviously, I prefer if you hit 5, but, you know, it's free country. You could choose whatever you want. Choose 5. And it helps other people find the show. And when people find the show, it's just good for everybody. So thank you for doing that. That's it. That's your Monday episode. Oh, wait. This is the Friday. Sorry. This is the Friday episode of Final Cut Grill. And yes, I'm going to keep trying to do two a week for as long as I can. I don't know about forever, but certainly for a while now. All right. Take it easy. We'll be back Friday. No, we'll be back Monday, the end of the weekend, with another episode of The Grill. Later, later. This button.